everybody back wherever you are. I'm Mary Flynn of Blackbird, and it's wonderful to have Terry Hummer here in town, poet T.R. Hummer, who is the author of a number of books of poetry, great essays, the occasional story. He's been the editor of very fine magazines, now usually plies his trade as a teacher of arising poets at Arizona State University, and who was here for about 4 years in the late 90s, which was a treat in and of itself. He's somebody whose work I've certainly read for many years, and he's in the middle of a trilogy of books of poems now. The first was Ephemeron. The new one is Scandalon, which is available for your purchase right back there. And the next one will be coming at some point. Maybe he'll mention that, but we can hope for the future. And welcome our very good friend to have him here in town, T.R. Hummer.
Thank you, Mary. And thanks for making this happen, Mary and Greg and all the other folks here at VCU and the people at Chop Suey, which is new to me. It wasn't here when I lived here, but I'm delighted to see such a terrific bookstore here. What a great place. And a good place for a reading. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate very much your making the time in your day to come down on a Monday evening to a poetry reading. There's be other things to do. As Mary says, and usually when I go to do a reading, I either read from the latest book, whatever that might be, or I read a sort of scattergun, you know, greatest hits, whatever it might be, that from that point of view that I feel like. But tonight, as Mary suggested, I'm trying to outline a somewhat larger architecture than usual, which has to do with three books, which I can't think of them as a trilogy exactly because my publisher refuses to do so. They're not interested in this idea. They say it will not increase their marketing share of my book. It will not make my book of poetry sell four books instead of three to package them all together somehow. But they will, in fact, consent to make them all look in a uniform format. So you see these two having a similar look, and that's a good thing. So I just think of them to myself as this cluster of books. But they do, in fact, have a certain sequence. The first one, Ephemeron, and you'll notice right away that these books have odd titles, which may be another reason why LSU is not really interested in marketing them at all. it doesn't say sex in big letters. It says a weird word that you never saw before. And they're all doing that, so this is just suicidal on my part. Ephemeron, the word will sound familiar to you because it's related closely to an English word, ephemera, things that pass. Ephemeron, as if you know any Greek at all, you'd understand is the singular of that word. And it struck me at some point that it was interesting that English did not import the singular form, as if English-speaking people don't like to think of going off by themselves over the edge. They think everything has to go over the edge together. Is that part of our mentality? Maybe so. But I thought that the word deserved a shot. It does have some existence in English. There is an ephemeron flower that lasts a day. There is an ephemeron fly, like a mayfly, that lasts a day. But otherwise, the word really has no English existence. So ephemeron is about things that pass, individual things that pass, the things that pass in solitude, alone, into the darkness. It's very cheerful. Scandalon is an even more peculiar word. This word has almost no existence in English, except in theology, where it means basically anything that distracts a person from the true way, anything that misguides a person from salvation. So that for one person, a lover might be a scandalon, as it was for Paola and Francesca, who are in the second level of hell in Dante, because they were to each other a scandalon. For another person, it might be, I don't know, a stamp collection. You know, any old thing that takes your attention away from the path, anything that makes you not gravitate toward whatever is true in the Christian sense. Of course, the word comes from Greek also, like ephemeron. And in Greek, and this is where things to me get more interesting, in Greek it means the trigger of a trap. So that little thing on your mousetrap where you put the cheese, that's a scandalon in Greek, in ancient Greek, very ancient Greek. In English, it translates ultimately into the word scandal, and you see the connection. You know, a scandal is not merely something people gossip about. It's a trap. It's the distraction from the true way. It's a maze into which one falls, within which one wanders. In Christian terms, this happens to everybody all the time, forever in the fallen world, and there's no hope for anybody except people. So, this is a very cheery book, too. Eon, which is finished and is sitting on my editor's desk, and he's refusing to read it because he says I've been presenting him with these manuscripts too fast and I have to slow down, so he will slow me down. This book is a completion of the three, at least in one very precise structural sense, in that it reiterates the other two. It's in three sections. The first section is called Murder, in which things die. The second section is called Urn, in which things are dead. And the last section is called Eon, in which things change. Urn, that section, is particularly focused on, as a presiding angel, on Sir Thomas Browne, who wrote Urn Burial, and he's one of my favorite prose writers ever. He's one of the great, crazy, beautiful prose writers, and his book Urn Burial is worth your time. But it's sort of all over that section of the book. But I like the way it sounds: Murder, Urn, Eon, Ephemeron, Scandalon, Eon. You know, the sounds of those words is what actually brought all this stuff together to begin with. It really just comes from the words themselves and from the language. So ephemeron is about passage and things that pass. And it struck me that in our culture, we have very few rites of passage. It seems somehow undemocratic or something to have rites of passage. Nobody takes you out into the woods and feeds you funny mushrooms and starves you and makes you have a vision and see a mystical hawk in the sky and sing a song to yourself and get yourself a new name and come back at the age of 14 full grown and ready to kill. This doesn't happen in our culture, and therefore it takes everybody at least 28 years to become an adult. That's just part of the deal. We do, however, have one rite of passage left, at least one, which you encounter at the age of 50. And this poem is about that. It's called Bad Infinity. During the colonoscopy, orbiting through twilight sleep, she felt, light years distant, in the interior darkness, a thump and a dull but definite pain, as if someone were dragging at the end of a rusty chain a transistor radio through her body. A small beige box with a gold grill, assembled by a child in Southeast Asia in 1964. And she woke in groggy panic until the nurse made soothing noises for her to sleep by, like a song in an alien language heard through the static beam from the far side of Arcturus, the Dave Clark Five's Glad All Over, maybe, tuned in by a boy in Thailand. Such a drug, the doctor said. Everything you feel, you will forget. Amen to that. Amen to plastic and silicone. Amen to a living wage. Amen to our tinny music, to the shrapnel and the IV drip. Amen to the template of genes that keeps the body twitching and the wormhole in the gut of Orion I will slip through when the chain breaks and the corroded battery bursts, its acids eating all the delicate circuitry that binds the speaker to the song. Fallacy of composition. The noon sky darkens with flying bodies. The extinct birds live in the mind, therefore the extinct birds live. The color of the day deepens with memory. All the wreckage of history is eclipsed. The blacksmith raises his hammer, and the red-hot horseshoe straightens into an iron bar. Consciousness moves like a shadow in the forest, and whole peoples are restored. An arrow flies over a rabbit's shoulder, and the rabbit continues, but the children eat nevertheless. The body testifies without speaking. By walking upright, it makes visible what lies within. Another artillery shell is canceled. Another family prays and falls asleep. A place remains at the empty table for the son who was vaporized. A bed is made and waits, though the others sleep on the floor. In the silent house, nobody hears the couple who struggle to conceive how the mind will bring him back, how the fact is broken. When I was a college student, there were many ephemeral things. I suppose there still are, you know, but think back to the 60s and all the things that we thought were very important and just sort of washed away, disappeared. Everybody who was in college had lots of posters on their walls. I suppose they still do. They're probably different posters now, though. You know, no more Janis Joplin posters, I guess. But there was one poster that a lot of people had on their walls in the dormitory room. The first time I ever saw this image was on somebody's dormitory room wall. And I still am transfixed by it. I'm still interested in it. It's a woodblock by Albrecht Dürer, the German medieval/Renaissance artist whose technique was almost photorealistic in many of his paintings. But in his woodblock, there's something else going on. The woodblock is called Melancholia, and it shows, you may know this, it's a famous thing, but in the 60s, all the hippies had it on their, why did we? What was it about this that made us want to put it up there on the wall next to Janis Joplin? I have no idea. Still don't know. It shows an angel who's sitting on a piece of stone, staring out over an ocean. The sun is low on the horizon, whether it's sunrise or sunset, we are not clear. And he's staring intently out across the water with a sort of expression of privileged suffering on his face. You know, and all around him, there are the implements of knowledge. Mathematical, alchemical, scientific for his time. I don't know, compasses, sextants, an alembic, a globe. And in the middle of all that, lying next to him, there is a dog with its eyes closed. And I was always interested in the dog. So I've written a poem in which, among other things, I believe I am the first person in history to give Dürer's dog a name. Which I thought he deserved. The poem is called Melancholia for Dummies. The sun has exploded in a black sky, but the angel, preoccupied by demons of his own, stares fixedly into a middle distance only angels care about. Dürer was onto something, but meditation is overrated. While the angel was tilting at mantras, his dog was fading. Dear faithful Cosmo, he who had followed through all the rings of being and 10,000 zones of torment, he who never questioned the wisdom of flying or cursing God or dancing on the heads of pins, old unquestioning creature, not nagging or asking why or where as he was dragged by a leash of molten gold from torture to beatitude to vastation, garden to comet, worn out with his master's infinite, dissatisfied agitation, he closed his eyes. And you, winged genius of despair, you want to know why you were thus blighted with angst? God takes his vengeance in obvious ways. Check out the doors of your perception, asshole. Look around. Your dog is dead. That depression. All right, I'm going to do one more from this. Now, this poem needs a little. It doesn't have to have, but I'm going to give it a little sense anyway. I long meditated on that part of the Odyssey in which Odysseus is told by the goddess to go to hell because he must find out something, and there's somebody there who he needs to talk to, Tiresias. The prophet, who will tell him some things he needs to know, because he's on his way home, and there's stuff waiting for him there that he can't anticipate, but Tiresias will give him some warnings. So, basically, she says, Odysseus, you're going to hell. Here's how you get there. There's a road map, or a sea map, as the case may be, but you got to take a bowl of goat's blood with you. Reason being that the spirits in the underworld have no memories just down there by themselves. But if they drink blood, drink maybe not be quite the right word, absorb, how do they do it? I don't know. They absorb blood. They take into themselves life again, and their memories return until it fades, and then they return to their state of unknowing again. It's really like a database, and one must have an interface, and the interface is a bowl of blood. We all have to have our bowls of blood, by the way. In life, and I think artists particularly need have got to, if you don't find your bowl of blood as an artist, you're not going to be an artist. You have to have it. It's always, to me, a very compelling image, this. In the Odyssey, when he goes down, they come swarming. The dead come, they smell the blood, and they come swarming at him like bats. And he has to sort of swat them away until he sees his mother. And he can't, even though he's not come to talk to her, he can't resist giving her some of the blood to drink. And he talks to her for a while. And then he sees Achilles and so on, and until finally he finds Tiresias. Well, this poem is about that story, but it's also about Iraq in 2008. Registry of the Corpses, the arrangement of which is a reverse chronology according to death date. Iraq, 2008. When the ship foundered, the hero, spared, entered the impossible mouth of the underworld. And there he encountered the bewildered soul of his third mate, just drowned on the stony beach, where ribs and riggings, oars and wineskins were scattered side by side with the bodies. Dripping with ectoplasmic brine, the translucent one struggled to speak, his larynx ripped away by the cluster bombs of dying. There was a great mission, a quest, an indisputable question, but the hero was struck down by sorrow. The bowl of goat's blood the gods had enjoined him to carry fell from his hands, and he turned back to forbidden daylight, where the bodies of his men, gall-pecked and slug-ridden now, he committed to flames and to decorous prayers. Only then did he go down again, now with a notebook and a ballpoint pen, where the dead were properly arranged in an infinite row, waiting for him. Let the gods do their own dirty work. This was a human duty. From the third mate back to the monkey, the spider, the amoeba, he gave them their proper place. He wrote them down. So Scandalon is about traps. This particular poem, many of these poems obviously are very much of the imagination. And to what extent material comes to me these days directly from life is kind of interesting to contemplate. I think the older I've gotten, the more filters there are, so to speak, for better or worse. This one, however, is something that actually took place in front of me one day. It has to do with people talking to themselves. You know, there was a time when if you were walking down the street and someone was talking to himself or herself, that was a kind of weird, edgy, suspicious thing. Why are they talking to themselves? Of course, the older I've gotten, the more I find myself talking to myself, so maybe that's suspicious too. But now, of course, people have other reasons for talking to themselves in public. The lover. Across the room, a woman is talking to someone. Her focus on the other is complete. Her eyes are fixed on the eyes of the one to whom she speaks almost prayerfully, as though with her words she washes the feet of the beloved, as if her speech is the long hair with which she wipes them dry. The intensity of her gaze, the eloquence of her gestures make it unimportant that no one stands facing her, that she talks into empty air, that she stares into a wall like someone insane. The tiny cell phone attached to her ear excuses her, but fails to explain how the greatness of her passion creates a form in the nothingness before her, how everyone envies the one to whom she is speaking, how all of us desire to be the one thus recreated. Text. The blues pianist's bleeding hands trace calligraphy on the keys. This, too, is art. And the rabbi's prayer on the killing floor, ritual slaughter as known as shikita. The knife is called a chalif. In Samoan, it ta means to strike, and hence tattoo. And the attendant percussion of wooden implements. This, too, is music. And the double paradiddle of ordnance in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, in the penal colony, the harrow writes on a man until he is dead. The tip of a large iron needle has gone through his forehead. You hold a book serenely in your hand. It is a gift. It is techne. Many human lives have been grotesquely crushed so that you may sit quietly with it in your chair, while a cat purrs in the crook of your arm. Outside, moonlight lays down its pentatonic line. The bright chisel of language descends in your brain. This, too, is an instrument. This, too, is a tool. In Phoenix, we now have a light rail system. It's about 10 feet long. It's a little longer than that, but it's very limited. They started building it before, while everything was flush, and then suddenly they ran out of money. They had all these grand plans. And what they have, though, is quite delightful. I it doesn't go anywhere I want to go, but I ride on it every time I have a chance just because I like it so much. And I was going through a little phase of riding on it, and I had two encounters within a week, one while I was traveling west and one while I was traveling east. And each was so odd in its way, and both the two of them together were so different that somehow or other I had to deal with them. So these two poems are what resulted from my thinking about this. The first one is called Westbound, and subtitled Little Cat Feet, which should put you in mind of that Sandburg poem, right? What happens here, again, and this has become relatively rare in my work, but what happens here is just about what happened on the train that day, except for some stuff added. And all the stuff I made up and all the lies. But other than that, it's just like it was. A universe of near unendurable suffering in which our fate is to receive pain rejoicingly in order to receive more pain. The man in the light rail car is bleeding from the chin. By now it's just an ooze, but his face and shirt are stained. And there is something, peculiar about his cheerfulness. An electrical storm rolling over the prairie of his hippocampus. What do you do for a living, he asks. And, told, ask again. I'm bloody, he says. Bicycle, and he points to where it hangs from a rack. It's mine. I'm restoring it. What do you do for a living? I like poems. This one's my favorite. The cat comes in on little cat feet. You know it. The cat comes in. The bicycle hangs perfect on the rack, dusty but well-oiled and functional. Restoration? The arc of our lives carries us forward, its pace controlled by an invisible metronome. He says that boys laughed at him when he fell. I said, fuck you! What do you do for a living? His hands worry the thickening blood on his neck. I like that poem too, I say. But it's fog. The fog comes in on little cat feet. And yes, he says, the cat comes in on little cat feet. And he slouches his arms, creeping. Arms out. See, it makes an image in my mind. When the prophet Elisha entered Bethel, the little children mocked his baldness. And the Bible tells us he turned back and looked on them and cursed them in the name of the Lord. And there came forth two she-bears out of the woods and tore 42 children from them. His bloodied hands shake. We are going somewhere. It makes an image in my mind. So then a week later, Eastbound, the Book of Enoch. I got onto the train with this little paperback edition of the Book of Enoch because I'm interested in Gnosticism. The Book of Enoch is a part of the Apocrypha, and it's part of the Dead Sea Scrolls, etc., etc. It's a Gnostic document. It's all about angels and their angels mating with humans and giving birth to giants. And it's a fantastic, weird thing. And, you know, I just thought, well, I'm going to ride the train. I'll just read this book while I ride the train, and I thought nothing about it. Eastbound, the Book of Enoch. We recognize the man with the whip by his smell, even in the dead of night, as we call it, even when we sleep, as we say, like a stone. He enters our dream, and the stink of his sweat wakes us just before the flagrum comes down. Commuters on the platform driven, train driven. The world is burning, Heraclitus wrote. East, the great desert takes the lash of solar flames. The man in the window seat is not perspiring. See, this was the first moment I felt suspicious. In Phoenix, if you're not perspiring in the summertime, there's something weird going on. A leather bag and a bottle of water rest in his perfect khaki lap. I resume the studies I started years ago, he says. I investigate the angels who are everywhere around us. The aisles of this train are full of them, and the platforms at the station. Some of us in these seats are angels. His face behind his sunglasses is serene as the train rolls smoothly. In the ancient book, canonical in Ethiopia, the angels lusted after the daughters of women. They made a pact of silence and fathered a race of giants who prospered and devoured the earth. My grandfather learned this from Addis Ababa. We must love everyone and be kind to every stranger, lest we offend God's agents. Beyond the horizon, there is a great mechanical quaking, the gears of the Imperium grinding into a corrosive bronze dust. And there I saw one who had a head of days, and his head was white like wool, and we recognize him because he punishes us for our inconstancy. We are not faithful to our being, like the stones or the fruits of trees. Therefore shall ye execrate your days, and the years of your life shall perish. Ye shall be blown across your desert lives like tumbleweed before the Mercedes Benz. Ye shall enter into office buildings, weeping, and drive yourselves, and marry, and suffer the everlasting scourge. This guy was perfect. He was beautiful. He was about 35, maybe. He was an African-American, as absolutely ebony, like a carved statue. His head was shaved, and he was wearing sunglasses. And he looked over and he said, "Oh, the Book of Enoch." I realized some days later that not far from where that station was, there was an Ethiopian Orthodox church. In the Ethiopian Orthodox church, the Book of Enoch is canonical. And so he must have been a member of that congregation, or else he actually was an angel. You know, I can be convinced by it. I'm not sure. It was a very strange experience. The Lover's Book of the Dead. In the metro tunnels of a strange city where every sign is in a tongue not hers, and no one understands her questions, she steps at random onto a crowded car and disembarks on a wasted plateau just at the snow line, where an ox cart full of children prepares for departure, and two old women argue the logistics of provision. Years ago, he told her he would wait for her here. He drifted on before her, but only just so far. And now she appropriates his hand, and they set out barefoot over the naked ice, 1,000 years ahead of them, a moment, nothing, their path obscure and irrelevant in the twilight, vanishing into a future of entanglement to the north, where a broken glacier grinds its own enjambments against themselves with a sound like sexual thunder. Well, let me give you some samples from Eon, and then I'll return back to a couple of other things and we'll be done. Patty Payne's Diet Editions very nicely did this little chapbook of this middle section of Eon, Urn, and I'll read a couple poems from that, and or a few poems from that in a minute. But first I'll read a few poems from the first part, which is called Murder. In that section, every poem is an example of one kind of murder or another, metaphorical or otherwise. That's enough to say. I went with my new wife and her mother to euthanize her mother's dog. It was an old, old dog. It was a beautiful Brittany Spaniel named Jasper. Her mother lives in Manhattan, so it was a strange experience. I mean, I've gone to veterinarian offices in a lot of places, but a veterinary office in Manhattan is a little different. You know, she lives in a high-rise building, and we went down, the doorman let us out. The dog, who had been almost dead, and that's why he was going to be euthanized, sort of rallied. He's like, "Oh, we're going for a walk." And down we went, and he jumped into the car. We summoned a special van, and he jumped in, and it took us down several blocks to the veterinarian's office, and the veterinarian was a complete jerk who seemed to have no soul. I was offended on the behalf of the dog. None of this stuff, these details are in the poem. I'm just telling you this because it's a curse on that veterinarian. He just sort of bloodlessly did this thing, and the old dog who was lying on the table died, and that was that. You know, and then we left him there. It was a wrenching experience, I must say, which I thought about a good deal afterwards. Water trial. Euthanized. The retriever lies dense with attention those last moments, then bares his teeth delicately to show he accepts this one final order. A life is a vessel of ice, hauling a cargo of water over a horizonless lake, and when the seams uncaulk and the bulkheads buckle, the surfaces disappear, prime matter collapsing into itself through the silver meniscus. Emptied, overmastered, carrying nothing home. Now, this poem, you can read this poem without ever thinking this thought, but it's helpful if you refer in the back of your head to the famous poem by Rilke called The Archaic Torso of Apollo, which many of you will know. It begins something like, depending on who's translating it, "We will never know that legendary head wherein the eyes, like apples, ripened." And famously ends with the line, "There's nothing here that does not see you. You must change your life." So I love that poem, and I thought I would write a poem in response to it in part, but also I thought it would be fun to combine it with sort of scenery from CSI. And it's the obverse story. This is called Legendary Head. Now, where did the head go? In a hat box left on a broke-back bench in a station of the Metro. In a gym bag abandoned on the courthouse lawn at midnight, marked by the dominant X of starlight, a little blood leaking from a raveling seam. Visionary, as though the ripening eyes were infused with napalm and mescaline. Somewhere, a torso, fragmented, stumbles, groping for its pedestal. Museums are choked with bodies. They are victims of a life they can never change. Who was he? We'll never know. We do not want to see him here. A lost effect. A crime. A severance package. Genotype. The old man stands at his kitchen counter naked, skinning rabbits. Out the window, a snowy field fluoresces in moonlight. The big knife is heavy in his hand. His hand is heavy. Gravity has made him a cruel marriage, but he survives it, reading a Kabbalah in the snow, which is inscribed with a chaos of tracks, as though a rack of rabbits had convened to observe an execution, lingered to ruminate a while, then moved on. Lots more stuff gets killed in that part. The funeral urn might be regarded literally as the ultimate scandalon. This is where your atoms from your body get trapped and never get out until somebody breaks the damn thing, you know. This is why I want to be vaporized after I'm dead, just so all my atoms can be free right away. You know, people get locked up in coffins and in urns and things like that. It's a trap, one might say. Or not. It may not matter much. Who knows? But this poem is all about, basically it's a series of elegies, each all the same length, each to a person. And one might think, indeed, to a group of random people, because in some sense, every death parallels every other. And so, in a way, it doesn't matter. But in another way, it does matter, because all these people are significant to me, and hopefully the poems make them significant to you as well. Some of them will already be significant to you. Others you won't know, but the poems will introduce you to them, but only post-mortem, you might say. And all through here, there's dissolved, if you hear here and there a peculiar word, it's probably a quote from Sir Thomas Browne, because there's a lot of Sir Thomas Browne scattered around in here. And little bits of him are interred inside this urn, too. It's his own fault. I blame him. So each is an elegy. Rania Maria Rilke, 1875 to 1926. There is a song the body sings to itself about time's arrow that has pierced its sentimental, shining heart, about the eternal flow of fire over the medulla oblongata and the oceanic backwash of lymph in the cells and interstices. Call that song an angel. Call it space. The body sings and does not know or care about the corrosive dark matter sealed in burial urns. The body sings, and when it stops for breath, nothing sings back its harmony. Luis Portera, 1949 to 2009. Who is Luis Portera? You have no idea. Luis Portera was a guy I was in a band with in the 60s. He was a bass player. He always said, he was very handsome. He always, and a really great guy, a nice guy. He always said, I'm only in this until I'm done with college, and then I'm going to medical school, which is exactly what he did. Hung up the bass as soon as he graduated, and as far as I know, never looked back. Became a doctor. And about, well, last year, I guess, I learned that Lewis had died. Now, I hadn't been in touch with Lewis since he hung up the bass and went away. But I was deeply shocked to discover that he had died like 5 years before, and I didn't know it. Why should I know it? Nevertheless, he was somebody who mattered to me somehow, even though I'd forgotten about him almost, even though, you know, he was just back there somewhere. We don't have people like that, right? Luis Portera, 1949 to 2009. At graveside, they practice the prosody of passage. One must suppose a grave. They do their best to say what a life was made of. That was oceanic music, like the last tide before a quantum Armageddon. Harmonics to the event horizon, counterpoint of fistula. Some find sepulchral vessels containing liquors which time hath encrassed into jellies. They have put something into a hole and covered it. That which is gone must be concealed. No, that which goes nowhere must be made invisible by an act of will. There was music once, somewhere, and people danced. He remains there, encrassed to a conscious liquor in his own sepulchral vessel. Hermes Trismegistus, dates non-existent. You know Hermes Trismegistus? I don't want to have to explain it. Never embodied one, the issue of death is altered for you. But it does not vanish, does it? For unvanishing, you persist in the torqued minds of Rosicrucians, broke-backed sorcerers, and students of the ahistorical Yeats. One knuckle bone from your least finger would strike them blind. Yet I knew you, myth. You were that old woman on the staircase. You were that swarm of bees. You were that expression of everything that is the case. When you died, I alone heard the pneuma go out of you. Not because I was wise or willing, but because I happened. Philosophers say, the world whirls. You should know, you are one. Martin Heidegger, 1889 to 1976. You know him, right? The most famous philosopher of the 20th century, or perhaps the most evil, blighted genius of the 20th century, depending on how you feel about it, or both, if you like. You make the choice. A great philosopher and a fascist, so you had to sort of put that together somehow. A real fascist, too, not just a forced fascist. He was so weird that even the Nazis threw him out. he went too far for them. Perpetual noon. The sun stalls while armies march on the city. Somewhere, stuck in that absence, the old man sits down at a plain wooden table. An assembly of statues watches him write. He who lives by the phenomenon will die of entropy. Having signed his own death warrant, he lies down to wait. Stones from war engines batter the forum. Catapults arc in the severed heads of spies and citizens. When do you stop being a philosopher? Ancient frugality was so severe that they allowed no gold to attend the corpse, but only that which served to fasten the teeth. He is a mist now over the graveyard the enemy flattens. Mary Helen Jackson Hummer, 1885 to 1978, my grandmother, my beloved grandmother. A tureen of soup steams on an embroidered tablecloth, and the family gathers for a farewell dinner. Grandmother sits in a chair in the corner. Yesterday, he was born. A moment ago, he played on the kitchen floor. She understands the cliche of memory in the moment of letting go, but her intelligence fails her. It was not even yesterday. Time is not a soup spoon or even a hairball of tesseracted tangles. Steam has risen from the stoneware bowls eternally. She has always sat on this chair in her agony of loss. I is not even an other. I is an absence. Mose, a tabby, 1971 to 1986, best cat ever. He followed the rat of oblivion into a culvert pipe, for the smell of rat's blood was imperious and impossible and wrong. The route ran deep and uncertain, but he could hear the furious scuttling, and he heard the cries of the upper world, bird-like and windy and human. But he had to go where the black tail curled for his hatred of poisonous vermin, till he ripped that throat and drank that breath and slept on that fire-blasted hearth. I'll read two more poems and then finish up. First, I want to go back to Ephemeron and read the title poem. This poem was written long before any of these others. I wrote it in about 2001 or so. No, before that, I wrote it in 2000. And my plan then was to include it in a book I was writing then called The Infinity Sessions, but it wouldn't fit. It just wouldn't go in there anywhere. You know, I kept trying and it wouldn't. And so then it fell out, and then it lay around, and I didn't know what to do with it or what it was or anything like that. But ultimately I realized that the word ephemeron was interesting me in strange ways right about that time. I have two daughters. One is 37 now, and the other is 13. I recommend this gap between children. It beautifully sublimates sibling rivalry. But I will also tell you that people ask me, what's the difference between having a child at that time in your life and having a child at this time in your life? And one difference was that when the first child was born, when the second child was born, there was a whole lot more stuff to buy. Furthermore, apparently humans had evolved to the point where if you didn't buy that stuff, your child would die. Whereas when I had the first child, it wasn't the case at all. You didn't have to buy all that stuff. I mean, what's up with that? That's a small point. The big difference to me between my earlier incarnation in fatherhood and my more recent incarnation as a father is that having a child at this age deepens almost to the point of the unbearable my sense of my own mortality. Because deeply, I love that child, and every time I look at her, I think, I'll be dead, you'll be here. You know, what do I need to do for you now? To provide for you after you're gone. I mean, beyond just trying to save money, which is very hard to do, as you know. But so there must be something else, therefore. So what? You know, and in some sense, this poem was written in response to that kind of question. And I conceived in the beginning of writing an instruction manual for my daughters, you know, and then I realized that was terribly pretentious and stupid, and that was not something to be done, you know, so just forget that. But this one poem arose, and then the other poems in this book began to arise in response to it somehow. So this is the seed, in effect, really, of all three of these books. And her birth is the actuating moment, or even her conception is the actuating moment of the arrival of all of this work. So all of it is dedicated to both my daughters. Ephemeron. Those are windflowers glowing in the outer darkness just beyond the gateposts. Oh, I should tell you also, this poem is set in Richmond. I'm looking out the window of my house up there on Church Hill, where I used to live. Those are windflowers glowing in the outer darkness, just beyond the gateposts. If I squint, I see them clearly. White windflowers, flicker of star gas, bridal veil nebula, an infinity bent by the gravity of dawn and rain, but opening. It astonishes me again. I'm 50 and pregnant. And beyond the bedroom window, September is gathering its cosmological light. A child, the windflower says. What's that? Nothing. Or hardly anything 5 weeks beyond conceiving. and that monstrous morning star above the neighbor's gable mutters, "Enough. What's one more human?" Heartless, these elemental things. Mist on the sidewalk, glitter. And so there are gods again, suddenly. The windflower opens its oblivious scripture as the sun advances degree by omniscient degree. In the street, a shadow of sparrows echoes the oil slick left by yesterday's downtown express. Details gather ominously, and that is the point, precisely, a god's favorite trick, the accrual, like money in the bank, of our undoing. But at arm's length away, the anti-entropic womb of my sleeping wife is growing a consciousness. Listen, zygote. The windflower's true name, anemone. Its true vocation, to be blowing against a wooden gate at 6 a.m. in the broken dawn light of the 50th September of a man old enough to refuse to be ashamed of his own joy. And the windflower's fate? No matter. It is enough now to watch it being. It is enough to be myself, again, almost a father, watching the newsboy wander the street, feeling almost the old god's abstract hearts contract. I smell them gather above me like ravens, wheeling over the promise my body makes. Black-hearted godhood has left them hungry, but it is they who assemble in the amniotic sac bits of star grit, skeins of DNA, the holy chemistry of existence. What can I do but leave them to it, even knowing what I know? My spiritual autobiography is a shambles in progress, my unfinished confessions a creaking stylized fiction from a distant century. It reads like a pirated version of a bad translation of a novel the young Balzac wrote, then threw away. No god forgives such things. The gods have taste. Smelling an uncouth sulfur in the aura of the coming day, the supreme will wrinkles the great face, the gaze averts, and here's our chance. A space opens. Ambiguous territory, zygote. Translucent. Our place. So I'll give you one more. This is a short one, and this is from the last section of Eon, a section called Eon. And I read this poem with particular pleasure, because I was married again on the 3rd of June to a wonderful woman who I wish was here. She was here yesterday, but had to leave. But not permanently. This poem is a poem that, in a sense, I owe the last section of Eon especially to her, and is dedicated to her. This poem in particular is special to us both, and we had it read by a friend of ours at the wedding. We had a lot of poets at the wedding. We invited Greg, and he didn't come, so he could have read a poem too, and so could Michelle. But they had to stay here and try to get promoted. So, you know, that's, that takes precedent. But my friend David Baker was there, and he read a poem, and that was great. And then we had his friend, Paige Starzinger, read a poem. And then Beth's matron of honor, her very dear friend, Marnie Hillsley, who, unfortunately, as we now know, is in stage 4 cancer. We knew it then, too. Read this poem for us, and so it was a very moving moment, and a special moment, and one that, you know, we'll never forget. The poems in this section are originally didn't have titles. They had letters, you know, it was a sequence, and so I didn't give them titles at first, but then I didn't like it that they didn't have titles, but then I didn't know what to title them, so I just titled each one the first little phrase in the first line. And so this one is called A Street Corner. And remember, this whole section then is about, you might say, rebirth. If at this stage in my life I'm granted anything even remotely resembling rebirth, I owe it to Beth. A street corner in Chicago. A street corner in Cairo. A street corner in Beirut. Dharamsala, San Francisco. Called together by the great inaudible horn, by the klaxon on the bow of the ship of summoning. Drawn together by the secret complementary spin of the atoms in our fingertips, we meet again. You, my unknown other, call it that, my interior soul, numinous, yet in this light no more than who you are. A body meets my body everywhere in the earth's infinite inventory. Thank you enormously much for